From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Lily Tomlin talks with us about her characters, her movie roles, and the incredible mess she made out of one of her first auditions. Also, we meet members of the South Bronx arts group Tim Rollins and KOS, that's for Kids of Survival. The group got started when Rollins took over an art class of learning disabled students. Their work has been shown in several museums. Now they have a major exhibition in Manhattan. Commentator Eileen Segalov defends the LP in the wake of the CD craze. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews the upcoming docudrama Howard Beach, Making the Case for Murder. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. Rebel troops attacked the Philippine Army headquarters in Manila today, and government helicopters blasted their positions in an effort to bring the two-day-old insurgency to an end. About 200 rebel troops, backed by tanks and armored cars, tried to lay siege to the headquarters at Camp Aquinalato, ending government hopes for a quick end to the coup launched yesterday. Government military spokesman General Oscar Florendo said one helicopter pilot was wounded by ground fire from the mutineers and said the helicopters were attacking the rebel marine units who were trying to reach Aquinalato. President Bush and Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev are both aboard their Navy ships off the coast of Malta and are resting for the night in preparation for tomorrow's summit. NPR's Jim Angle reports from Malta.
President Bush arrived here looking a bit haggard after flying all night and went immediately to a meeting with local officials. He spent the rest of the day with the U.S. Navy, joking with sailors and watching Navy pilots show off for the commander-in-chief. In a speech to sailors aboard the USS Forrestal, the president said the walls of oppression are tumbling down, and he gave the ship a piece of the Berlin Wall as he talked about the changes in Eastern Europe.
We all recognize a dynamic new Soviet leader willing, as Lincoln said, to think anew. And we want him to succeed because we do admire the people in the Soviet Union.
Tomorrow morning, the president will begin those efforts with President Gorbachev aboard the Soviet ship Slava. I'm Jim Angle with the president in Malta.
The Czechoslovakian Communist Party changed 21 years of policy today by announcing a reassessment of the events of 1968, the year the Soviet Leninization ended what is known as Prague Spring. NPR's Deborah Amos reports from Prague.
For 21 years, the Communist Party here has held firm that the Soviet-led invasion was justified to crush a counter-revolution. In the past 48 hours, the Prime Minister and the head of the Communist Party have promised to question the invasion, today followed by the Czechoslovakian Communist Party. Also today, in a separate statement, the party's top ideological body said the invasion was a mistake. Civic Forum, the powerful opposition group here, has demanded this concession. It has enormous implications for the party because it questions the legitimacy of the policy for the last 20 years and the state structures put in place after 1968. President Gustav Husak was involved in the planning of the invasion. Civic Forum has demanded his dismissal. In Prague, this is Deborah Amos.
Lebanese President Elias Harawi reportedly has asked the United States, Soviet Union, and France to convince General Michel Aoun to avoid another battle with Syrian forces. Harawi said he was trying to avoid a military showdown. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 41 points to close at 2747. This is NPR News. Energy Secretary James Watkins said today that plutonium operations stopped indefinitely at the Rocky Flats nuclear plant. They'll be stopped until all safety concerns are met. Watkins also announced a management shakeup at the plant and said the new management structure will make the plant more responsive to safety concerns. Among the questions to be addressed, Watkins said, is whether stray plutonium dust at the plant has accumulated in enough quantity to cause a nuclear reaction. By 1993, the Sears Tower may no longer be the world's tallest building. Developers in Chicago plan to build a structure that is 15 stories taller. Cheryl Corley of member station WBEZ in Chicago reports.
The developer of this towering project, 43-year-old Paul Beitler, says it represents a return to skyscrapers built by private developers and not by giant corporations like Sears. The building would be just two blocks from the current world's tallest building. It would rise 125 stories. 1,950 feet to the tip of its spire. That's 396 feet above Sears Tower's roof, which has made some Chicagoans already dub the proposed building the Chicago Sky Needle. Architect Cesar Pelli says the building will include a parking garage, a culture center, and an observation deck. It's expected to cost between $300 and $400 million. Chicago's Planning Commission has okayed the building. Approval must come next from the City Council, followed by financing commitments. For National Public Radio, I'm Cheryl Corley in Chicago.
Colombia's Interior Minister Carlos Lemus Simons said today it is possible that drug-backed groups are responsible for the bombing Monday of the Avianca jetliner in which all 107 people on board were killed. Lemus said the extraditable still had not denied a statement made by a caller on Monday, lending their name to and responsibility for the accident. I'm Frank Stacio, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We knew her first from her character Ernestine, the telephone operator on Laugh-In. Then we got to know Lily Tomlin through her other characters, like the 5-year-old Edith Ann, Tess the bag lady, and Tommy Velour, the lounge singer. She brought her characters together in several Emmy Award-winning TV specials and two Tony Award-winning Broadway shows. Lily Tomlin also starred in the films Nashville, The Late Show, 9 to 5, The Incredible Shrinking Woman, All of Me, and Big Business. Tomlin's just revived her one-woman show, The Search for Signs of Intelligent Life in the Universe. It's running through the end of the year in Philadelphia. Although each character she does in the show seems to reveal something about herself, the show is actually written by Jane Wagner, who has written most of Tomlin's material since 1972. I asked Lily Tomlin how she and Wagner worked together to create the characters.
Jane absolutely writes for her own satisfaction, you know. And no matter how much I ask her to write for me, I can't influence her to that degree. I mean, she's going to write something when she wants to or she feels inspired to write it. So occasionally I might, there might be something that I've begun to physicalize that I would like to have something beautiful and definitive to for whom to say, you know, words for that character. And I will implore her to do it for me. And finally she might, but mostly she will just hand me material. I mean, that's why I sought her out in the first place, because I was so attracted to her sensibility, and I wanted so much to deepen what I was doing. And I just understood what she was. I understood her for some reason.
I'm interested in how you developed your style of character comedy. When you first started performing, did you ever do stand-up?
Well, that's how I was characterized, as doing stand-up, but I always did monologues. And I always wanted them to have content, and I wanted them to have relevancy, and I wanted them to have a beginning and an end and, you know, shape and this and that. And even if I would invent a first-person approach to something, I would eventually put it in the mouth of a character because it was just more telling. It was stronger, more definitive, had more shape, more essence. And but I did it in clubs all the time. I mean, I'd force the poor old nightclub audience to just sit there and watch a long, you know, like a 10 or 15 minute monologue. And I would never, and I, once I was committed to that, I would just do it.
So who were some of the early characters that you developed before television?
Well, the very first character I ever did was the Tasteful Lady. And that was, I was in college and I was in pre-med, and I never expected I never expected to go into show business, and so, but I got into a college show, and they were doing vignettes and things like that, and I thought they were very sophomoric and empty, and they were nothing but parodies of television shows, and it turned out they needed some more material. The show was a little short, so I realized watching them that I did stuff like that, that I did little character, you know, hits, and so because we were living in Detroit, and Grosse Pointe is one of the rich suburbs of Detroit, and it was segregated at that time and had just been exposed. I used to do a kind of Grosse Pointe matron, and that's what I did. I when the student producer of the show was like kind of going around tearing his hair out, saying we need some material, I said, well, maybe I have something we can do. So I was able to just improvise around my social activities and my charitable works and my daughter's debut party and things like that. And of course, it was a sensation in the show because it was the only thing that had any content. And then I went on all the local shows and did it. And I thought, gee, this, you know, I thought if I could only make a living doing this, it would be wonderful.
Did you ever think you'd get trapped in that character? Did you know right away you had other characters,
oh,
too?
Oh, no, I never thought of that. That never occurred to me. No, no, it was just, that was just one expression of something.
So what was the next character?
Then I did the world's oldest beauty expert, and that was Lupe, Madame Lupe, and she's a character who, by her title, is very old, and her face is somewhat deteriorated. And then she rejuvenates it through a series of exercises and application of cream. And then she sneezes and it all falls down.
What would you do for auditions when you went to New York?
I could hardly ever get an audition. I couldn't sing. I mean, I wasn't trained to sing. And I got one audition with Julius Monk at the Plaza. And it was horrendous, humiliating. The person who sent me said he'd never speak to me again. I had totally jeopardized his reputation. And
what did you do that went so badly?
Well, who knows what I did. First of all, I didn't even have pictures.
Uh-huh.
And I had just participated in a documentary about Kitty Genovese, who was the young woman in New York who was murdered on the street. And while 38 people watched or listened and did nothing to help her. And so I was playing Kitty Genovese, and it really consisted of very little except being dragged around the street. And but then I happened to have a production shot of myself lying on a stretcher, and the director had wanted me to have my eyes open, and so the photographer had shot me, but he was leaning over me shooting, so it was a very strange angle and a very strange expression, but it was the only picture I had of myself, and I took that picture and gave it to Julius Monk when I went to this audition. And and also, the only song I knew, I had a wind-up Victrola, because I used to collect old 30s records, and I had a great old 30s record by Francis Maddox and the Playboys called There's Not a Real New Yorker in New York, and a very sophisticated, you know, kind of song of that period, and just the kind of thing that you would think would appeal to Julius Monk. But the bad part was I had learned it on this wind-up Victrola, so it didn't keep time. So when I got my friend of mine who played the piano, who could, you know, transpose and play quickly, I didn't have the record, but I tried to sing it for him, and he'd say, it can't be like that. I said, that's how it is. I couldn't learn it any other way because I'd learned it so, it was so imprinted on me in this strange, wavering time. And so you can imagine, and plus I was a nervous wreck. I mean, my legs are shaking, you know, in Harry Kellerman. When Barbara Harris does that audition and she's literally holding onto a pole, that's just about what was happening. I mean, I was sagging on a pole. I had dry mouth. I could barely get a sound out of my mouth. And then I had given him this awful picture of me lying on a stretcher. And so finally I had to say, and but he was very gentlemanly, and he let me, even after I finished this first song, which was just horrendous, he said, did I want to sing another one? Of course, I didn't have another one, so I tried to sing God Bless America. And then he would try to be cordial, and he said, thank you, or something like that. And I said, well, if you're not, in an effort to try to understand where we stood, I said, well, if you're not going to hire me, then I want my picture back. And that's so my friends, this friend, this sort of acquaintance who had sent me, said that, you know, he said, well, I'll never send you for anything again, and you've totally jeopardized my professional reputation.
Lily Tomlin's my guest, and she's revived her one-woman show, The Search for Signs of Intelligent Life in the Universe. So what was your first big break? Was it before Laugh-In?
No, well, I mean, in terms of really high-profile public recognition, it was Laugh-In.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, before that, I would say, you can trace it back as far as you can go. You could trace it back to when I got on, well, here's how far back I would go. It's more fun to start at the beginning. Let's say I got on Laugh-In, right? Well, how I got on Laugh-In was because George Schlatter saw a monologue that I'd done on Merv Griffin about a woman addicted to eating rubber objects. And how I got on Merv Griffin was I had played at the Upstairs or the Downstairs, and I got a great review in the New York Times from Vince Canby. He was doing nightclubs in those days. And I took that review, and I went to an agent who's died now. Her name was Gloria Sapphire. And I knew it was a small agency. I didn't want to get a big agency because I was totally unknown, and I wanted someone to pay special attention to me. And I went to see her, and I took that review, and she sent me over to the Merv Griffin show.
I remember when you used to do Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
You'd come out with a little notebook
uh-huh.
and read observations about daily absurdities.
Yeah.
That you jotted down in this little notebook. Did you actually keep a notebook like that?
I did for a while, yeah. I mean, that concept was largely Jane's idea because she can write so epigrammatically anyway. And even in the play, I mean, even though she's moving character and plot forward, almost every line has a perception. It's kind of astonishing. It's almost like, I forget how someone put it, it was almost like they said what the couplet was to Pope. You know, somehow she's almost able to write satire in couplets and one-liners and stuff, and yet she moves the plot and the character forward, and it seems naturalistic.
Lily Tomlin is my guest, and she's revived her one-woman show, The Search for Intelligent Signs of Life in the Universe. And we'll talk more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Lily Tomlin is my guest. In your early days of TV, when you're doing shows like Laugh-In', did you have people writing for you? Were you ever given lines that you thought were really offensive?
Oh, yeah. And I was George Schlatter. You mean talking about Laugh-In'?
Sure, yeah.
George Schlatter, who was the producer and who's a friend of mine, I'd go to him and I'd say, George, I can't say this or I can't do this. And he'd say, okay. He'll say someone, you know, and he'd give it to somebody else and they would do it. But even now, occasionally, when I have the misfortune to see myself on an old Laugh-In' rerun, I mean, I say that only because you just cringe sometimes, you know. A lot of people enjoy it. They tell me they really like it and much of it. But sometimes I see stuff I do. I can't believe certain things left my lips.
Like what?
Just stuff, awful stuff. Just, I thought I had so much consciousness, you know, but... Believe me, I didn't.
Are you diplomatic or theatrical when you're refusing to do something?
Depends on the circumstance. sometimes you can be diplomatic, and then sometimes you have to be theatrical.
What was your most theatrical way of saying no?
Oh, well, there's no way to describe this. This is just, you couldn't possibly do this in the media. I couldn't reveal myself. I mean, first of all, there's no limit to the language.
Right.
And there's no limit to the decibel level. And I've been in situations where it's just like, it just comes short of like, you know, beating each other with sticks. I mean, it can be extremely explosive and extremely over the top.
Lily Tomlin is my guest. You've acted in several movies. And I think your first role, or at least the first role I saw you in, was Nashville.
Mm-hmm.
Where you played the mother of two deaf children.
Right.
And this was not a comic role. And it was a really interesting change for
I think I got that role, too, because Altman didn't even, you know, he had no idea who I was.
Oh, so he couldn't typecast you.
Yeah, he didn't think that I was Ernestine like most everyone else did.
Oh, so what are some of the things you've learned about yourself as an actress working in other people's movies? You know, after working on your own on stage for so long.
Well, I have a hard time very often in a movie because... I don't always understand the writer's or the director's vision.
Because you're used to having your own and Jane's, who you know very well, so it's a shared vision.
And so the things that they might select to depict the character sometimes don't serve what I think should be communicated. So I usually, and sometimes you have an easier time of it than others, like depending on the director's flexibility
mm-hmm.
and receptability. You can come in with a whole bunch of stuff and let him or her select from it if it pleases them. Like, for instance, in 9 to 5, every single scene, I had it prepared from about 100 different angles because I couldn't understand always what the intention was going to be. And because I would be trying to get in something that clarified it for me, I would try to get it in at all different angles, you know, whether it was... Because I wanted Violet to be kind of the earth mother of the office because I wanted her to have several children, first of all, so that there'd be a reason for her to put up with Hart, the boss who so abused her. And I went to Colin, the director, and I said, I'd like to have, you know, like about six kids. I'd like to have some triplet bluebirds. And I want my mother to live with us, you know. And then I have this teenage boy, and I want a couple other kids. I wanted a whole bunch of kids, and I wanted them to be running in and out. When I'm talking to my son fixing the garage, I wanted the kids to be running in and out of the garage, you know, getting animals and cages and, you know, just like it's just a menagerie of every possible creature walking and flying. And then, I, of course, I wanted a lot of kids' pictures pasted to my desk and all that stuff. And I wanted to always be taking the paper out of the wastebasket to take it home to my kids so they could draw on it, you know, be smoothing the paper out.
So whenever you do a role, do you go through that elaborate a process to figure out who
sometimes,
your character is?
Sometimes. Mm-hmm. In a film particularly, as I say, only because I'm have a very hard time understanding the other person's vision.
Lily Tomlin is my guest. You're a feminist and grew up in the 50s, right? So you were coming of age before the contemporary feminist movement. Did you think of yourself when you were growing up as a, looking back, do you think when you were growing up that you were something of an intuitive feminist?
Yes, undoubtedly.
In what ways?
Well, first of all, I was extremely independent.
Mm-hmm.
I knew right. I was class conscious, extremely class conscious.
Yeah, and you were from working class family,
right? And I was also very conscious of what options my father had as opposed to my mother. Even though I understood my father also had fewer options than somebody who was better educated, who had a whole, you know. Just came from a different background, and so I understood the subtleties of all that, or some of them, let's say. I don't want to be too grandiose here in my perception. And then, and I don't know, I never liked anything. It wasn't like I did feminist material. I just didn't like I didn't like material that was demeaning to me or anybody else. I just didn't like it. I didn't like it in... I didn't want to see myself do it, least of all, and I didn't like it in anybody else. And people would always say in those early days when you're doing stand-up, people say things like, oh, how can you do stand-up and stay feminine? How can you keep your femininity and do stand-up? You have to be so aggressive. And I say, you don't have to be aggressive, you know, and I don't want to see a man or a woman be aggressive or, you know, or do that kind of comedy. What's the point? So it wasn't like, it just didn't, whatever my sensibility was, it just didn't appeal to it.
You once described yourself as going through, when you were young, a semi-hood period.
Yeah, well, I certainly did that.
What is a semi-hood period?
Well, it's almost like role-playing. You know, I was probably already a performer since I was a child because I always put on shows and I loved all these different people in our neighborhood and in our old apartment house. I mean, everybody was so interesting and so different and yet so similar. And all the different accents and the different foods and the different way they furnish their house and their politics or their lack of politics. So in a way, I think all those things were like costumes. You know, I played almost every role. I was very socially mobile, and I was hoodie part of the time. Then I'd be Ivy League. Then I'd be kind of artsy-craftsy, and then I was bohemian, beatnik. You know, it's like a different role to play.
Well, playing
of course, it expresses your politics, whether intuitively or not at that time.
Well, also, I think playing the hood and playing the bohemian can also get you out of having to play a mainstream gender role. Do you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
Like the you know, classical.
Although
female.
Hoodie girls were pretty much, you know, like off the cover of True Confessions.
Did you ever dress that way?
Oh, God, for sure. We go with Paul Malls, big lipstick, you know.
Now, your mother was a nurse's aide. Your father worked in a factory.
Right.
He was an alcoholic, I believe.
Yeah.
Did you have to grow up quickly because of that, and take some of the control of the family into your own hands?
Oh, sure, I did. Yeah, I have a brother, but I was the oldest of the two, and you just do. I think blue collar kids are just more conscious of that kind of thing anyway. You live in a smaller house.
Mm-hmm.
You know pretty much everything that's going on.
How did the women's movement affect you as a performer? You were already performing when the women's movement really started organizing in the late 60s. You were already an intuitive feminist, but How did the presence of a movement help you out?
It stopped people from, you go on a talk show and it became less acceptable for people to say, well, don't you want to have any children?
Right.
You know, or something like that. I mean, it just expanded everybody. If it didn't expand them organically, it expanded them superficially enough so that they had a different mode of behavior in public.
One last thing. I want you to describe what you wore to the Academy Awards ceremony when you were up for an award for Best Supporting Actress from Nashville.
Do you really?
Yeah.
Well, I wanted to go because the Oscars was, first of all, this was back in 1975 or whatever it was. And the Oscars was such a cultural event, and still is, but I mean, it really was then. And all you live your whole life, a child, a kid in Detroit, and the Oscars are like the ultimate experience. And, ultimate television pop experience. So I wanted to go as a 50s movie star. And I actually should have worn a blonde wig, but I didn't, because then it'd be hard to recognize me. So I wore my own hair. But I wore, I went to NBC's costume department and I got a knit dress that has like great sequins sewn, spangles, and it's very stretchy. It's kind of a Marilyn Monroe kind of dress. You have to be very fleshy to fill it out. And so I was padded. I padded myself just enough so that it looked real, but it was pretty voluptuous. And I had great big white foxes and great rhinestone earrings and a tiara and just loaded with rhinestones. And I had Harlequin rhinestone glasses on. And so I went, because my plan was if I won, I was going to go up and I was going to say, some of you will say I've gone Hollywood. But the best part was Mr. Blackwell, the next morning on TV, he said, "And Lily Tomlin wore a tiara. We just don't wear tiaras."
Did you feel then, or do you ever feel now, that you're like impersonating a celebrity,
No, not in this part I don't. But I mean, that kind of thing I do.
Yeah.
I mean, then I want to have fun with great cultural events, Like Ernestine was nominated for an Emmy a few years ago, and I went to the Emmys as Ernestine, and the Academy was just furious with me. Because they think, to me, it's the greatest tribute I can pay is that I'd be that invested, in Ernestine winning an Emmy. I mean, Ernestine would have given anything to win an Emmy. I mean, much more than I would. And so I made great elaborate preparations for her. She had two limousines. She had her own film crew. She had Irish wolfhounds. She had everything to present herself at the Emmys. And, of course, she didn't win. And when she didn't, I had a black silk hanky in case I didn't win. And Dwight Himian and Gary Smith were the producer and director, and so they thought this was funny. The president of the Academy, behind whom I was sitting, did not think it was funny at all. So when I lost, the camera was on my face for just a moment, and I was very stoic, and then I whipped out that hanky and sobbed into it. But I got the greatest postcard from a CBS executive the next day. She wrote me and she said, "Ernestine, you were a vision of dignity and pathos."
Lily Tomlin, thanks so much for
You're
talking
welcome.
With us. My guest has been Lily Tomlin, and her show, The Search for Signs of Intelligent Life in the Universe, will be in Philadelphia through December. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
A gracious hello. Here at the phone company, we handle 84 billion calls a year, serving everyone from presidents and kings to the scum of the earth. So we realize that every so often you can't get a call through. Perhaps your phone goes out of order for no apparent reason. Maybe you've been charged for a call you didn't make. We don't care. Watch this.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Our teacher, Tim Rollins, works with some of the most challenging students you could imagine, learning disabled kids from the South Bronx. But together, Rollins and his students have created paintings good enough to hang in the Museum of Modern Art. Coming up, we meet Tim Rollins and one of his students from the group KOS, that's Kids of Survival. Also, in these days of CDs and RDATs, Eileen Segalov sings the praises of the LP. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews the latest in the seemingly endless procession of telemovies based on real events. This one's about the Howard Beach murder. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. It's Saturday morning in the Philippines, where rebel troops attacked army headquarters and government helicopters blasted rebel positions in an effort to bring a two-day-old coup attempt to an end. About 200 rebel troops tried to lay siege to the garrison, dashing government hopes for a quick end to the coup. The U.S., responding to a request from President Corazon Aquino, has been providing air cover for government forces. A spokesman said that no U.S. personnel has been directly involved in any of the fighting. West German police are searching for a Red Army faction terrorist in connection with the bomb attacks yesterday that killed a leading West German banker. Deidre Berger has more from West Berlin.
Descriptions of a man leaving the site of the attack yesterday could identify him as 31-year-old Christoph Eduard Siedler, a Red Army terrorist wanted by the West German police. Authorities here say the precisely planned attack was almost certainly the work of the left-wing Red Army faction. Authorities think the attack was prepared months ago. Local residents report seeing a cable near the explosion site as early as October. The bomb was attached to a bicycle connected to the cable. Police believe the bomb was detonated by remote control when the car drove through a light beam. The West German government is offering more than $2 million in rewards for information leading to the killers. In Frankfurt today, about 10,000 people walked silently through the city's financial district in tribute to Alfred Herrhausen, who was chairman of Deutsche Bank. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Berlin.
And the East German parliament today amended its constitution to abolish the right of the Communist Party to run the government. This action meets one of the main demands of the opposition movement. Two government officials from El Salvador took a softer tone toward American woman, now under arrest in that Central American country. NPR's Mara Liasson has more.
In remarks today at the National Press Club in Washington, the Salvadoran officials said that they considered Jennifer Jean Casolo to be an honest person and a good American. Casolo was arrested Saturday after Salvadoran police dug up a cache of weapons from her yard. They claim the weapons belonged to the Salvadoran guerrillas. Today, the Salvadoran Undersecretary of Foreign Affairs suggested that Casolo was a naive person who has been used by the rebels. Casolo maintains that she has no military connections with the guerrillas, and she says she has no knowledge of how the weapons came to be buried in her backyard. Casolo's colleagues say they think that she has been set up by the Salvadoran government and that she is a pawn in their effort to discredit the church movement in El Salvador. Casolo worked for the Christian Education Seminars as a tour guide for Americans who came to El Salvador. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
On Wall Street, stock prices moved higher as the Dow Jones Industrials closed up over 41 points in heavy trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Commentator Eileen Segalov has a top-of-the-line home entertainment system, but she'd given away her turntable years ago. Recently, she bought a new one, and it got her to thinking about when LPs had no competition.
My first record ever was Bozo and the Birds. It was a 45 and came with a bright yellow insert, so it wouldn't float all over my record player. The record was scratched, and Bozo would say,
"Just turn the page whenever you hear me jump. Like this. Like this. Like this."
Over and over again. I loved that scratch. My parents hated it. When I wasn't looking, they snatched the record and hid it somewhere in the attic. I spent all my weekly allowance at the gramophone shop, buying 45s. I got this great little 45 carrying case, and I'd load up my music and go over to my friend Harriet's house for an afternoon of chocolate cupcakes and Frankie Avalon. Records were the first things that were ever really mine. On Wednesday nights, right before my parents had their bridge and mahjong game, I had two chores. One was to shake up the bridge mix my mom made from the Corn Chex cereal box recipe. The other was to wipe down the records. That meant using this round velveteen wand to get rid of any dust on Dad's LPs. He had some kind of radionic cobra tone arm attached to his silent speed record changing needle, and it hated dirt. These days, it seems that nobody's eating bridge mix or playing records. Everything's out on CD. If you go into a typical record store, you can hardly spot the LPs. And when you ask where they are, the salespeople look at you like you're on some kind of archaeological dig. But lately, I've discovered a whole new league of record stores, from humongous surplus warehouses to tiny nooks, with every kind of LP, 45 and 78 you can imagine. Yesterday, I ventured into a huge store near my house. The lower level had theme sections, mood music, Broadway show tunes, cowboy songs. Upstairs was the bin, endless aisles of who knows what, all for 94 cents. I found myself drawn to the easy listening section and pulled out two albums with colorful covers. Dancing girls in hula skirts posed in front of a painted tropical setting. This was Martin Denny plays Polynesia. The other cover featured the same dancing girls, this time in taffeta skirts, posed in front of a fountain spouting roses. This was Martin Denny does the rumba. I'm sure I cleaned these with Dad's magic wand. I spotted something I had to have. TV's Dr. Kildare, Richard Chamberlain sings Love Songs You Love, and TV's Dr. Ben Casey, Vince Edwards sings Sometimes I'm Happy, Sometimes I'm Blue. Hidden in the back of the store was a wooden crate with a big question mark painted on it. Inside were about 1,000 perfect What is Stereophonic Sound albums, still sealed in their original plastic wrap. They were the demo records that came with your newly purchased hi-fi. On the back of the album cover was a neat diagram teaching you how to hook up your speakers properly and how to sit in the middle of this stereo triangle so you could hear the orchestra as though all 35 musicians were right there in your living room. I happily left with 24 albums, a lot cheaper than buying 3 CDs. Records are so friendly. They're from a nuts and bolts kind of time, before hermetically sealed audio components, a time when you'd have the record player set on automatic replay and you'd hear, Tammy, Tammy, Tammy's in love. Play for the zillionth time, and then it would get muffled and weird, and you'd have to get up in the dark from the boy or girl you were kissing, and without worrying about microchips or circuit boards, without resoldering or searching for the instruction manual, you'd casually mosey over to the spinning circle glowing in the dark, and with a quick blow the dirt away and solve the biggest problem of the evening.
Eileen Segalov is a video and audio artist based in Los Angeles.
I hear the cottonwoods whispering above, Tammy, Tammy, Tammy's in love. The old hootie owl, hootie hoos to the dove.
This is Fresh Air. Tim Rollins and his group of Hispanic teenage students from the South Bronx make up one of the hottest art collaboratives around. The group goes by the name of KOS, Kids of Survival. Their work has been shown at galleries and museums in New York and Europe. Roberta Smith wrote in the New York Times that these students are producing artwork of a remarkable sophistication, which refuses to conform to known categories, but alternates between the literary and the visual, the modern and the naive. My guests are Tim Rollins and Carlos Rivera, one of the founding members of KOS. The DIA Art Foundation in New York is currently showing Tim Rollins and KOS's America paintings. The images are inspired by Franz Kafka's uncompleted novel America. The group painted directly onto the pages of the book, which were mounted on linen. This technique dates back to when Rollins formed the group in 1982. He was a special ed art teacher trying to find inspiration for his learning disabled students. Frustrated with the watered-down text his students were using, Rollins began to read to them from his own copies of unabridged classics.
Instead of the kids just, you know, staring at me or blanking out, I asked the kids to draw. And with number 2 drawing pencils, I'd have the kids draw not what I was reading. In other words, I didn't want them to illustrate it. I wanted them to draw what I was reading reminded them of in their everyday lives in the Bronx, whatever came into their mind. And so we produced tons and tons of drawings out of this. And I didn't really know what to do with them. In the very early works, we would do some like collaborative paintings, but Adalberto would have a corner here and Wanda would have a corner here. It wasn't all pulled together until one day, Carlito was in the class, and I think he's 11, 12 at that time. Mm-hmm. And he had just been in there. And I was reading from, I believe it's George Orwell's 1984. And I had the school really didn't provide paperback copies of that book. So I had got some of my own, and I had one that I loved to read from. It was a first edition, because I collect books. And it was in that first edition. I don't know, Carl has got it mixed up somehow, but he started, instead of drawing on paper what I was reading about, he started drawing on the book, in the pages themselves. I don't even remember what the image was, but... at first, you know, I really wanted to kill him. I go, what are you doing? You know, this kind of frustration. And it wasn't the kid's fault. It's just, you know, he just didn't understand what was going on. But what was really amazing is that Carlito really couldn't even read the word "the" at that time. But he, through my reading of the Orwell, he had come up with this kind of incredible image. He had completely assimilated the content of this book and understood it completely without being able to read it himself. And, you know, something was there. And I wasn't sure what it was. It's one of those things that, you know, bugs you for months and months and months, but there was something there in the levels of, you have the text and then you have an image on top of the text. And what it was, in a way, it deconstructed the text. In a way, it was like two layers of history. One, which is from a canon that was either denied or made useless to us. And the second layer, which is our drawing, is a reinterpretation of these classic texts in our own language, a language that we had a command of, a language of images.
Carlos, why did you, on that day, draw in Tim's copy of the book?
I decided to draw on the book because I thought it was more interesting instead of, you know, working on a piece of blank paper. I thought it was interesting working on top of words that I couldn't not read.
Mm-hmm. Tim, tell me how things work now when you're beginning to do a painting. Are you still reading out loud from a book?
Yeah, it comes to that. For example, in our new cycle of works, The Temptation of St. Anthony, which we're preparing for a major show in 1990 at the Kunstmuseum in Basel, the beginning of that also came with Carlos Rivera here. When he was 11 years old, I had a stack of art books. And I told him, go through this and pull out, you know, what you think, what's the most interesting thing here. And it was all, you know, it was like from the world history of art. And he said, well, I don't like any of it except for this one thing. And he pulls out a copy of Grunewald's medieval masterpiece, the Eisenheim altarpiece. And in that altarpiece, there's a panel with monsters, and it's based on the story of the Temptation of St. Anthony. So my first assignment to Carlos was to copy at an exact size with acrylic on a wood panel, just the way Grunewald did it, except he didn't use acrylic, but on a wood panel, copied it just exactly. After a week, Carlos had done exactly that. I mean, it was phenomenal. So I was particularly in love with Odilon Redon's lithographs of those that he did as illustrations for the text by Gustave Flaubert. So I started reading the text, The Temptation of St. Anthony by Gustave Flaubert, and my mind was blown. I thought this is a terrific, terrific book. So I started looking at sections of it that I thought the kids would really get into and started reading that to them. And then the kids go, yeah, it's really interesting, and let's think about it. Year goes by, 2 years go by. It's always in the back of my mind, it's in the back of the kids' minds. Then they start developing even more and more, and we went to Madrid and saw the Bosch painting. We went to the Museum of Modern Art study library and handled, you know, the entire cycle by Redon. We really started looking at what we could do with these things. And then we started inventing these new ways of painting with the watercolors by chance operations and colored powders and pigments. And then we started buying lab equipment and painting with things like little surgical spoons and syringes, really kind of creepy mad scientist gear all over the place. And it started, and what we came up with, which is still in development now, is this kind of amazing new way of making these paintings. And they're absolutely, they're demonic. They look biological or organic. They're hideous and fascinatingly beautiful and elegant at the same time, capturing perfectly the spirit of the Flaubert, but really pulling it into something that's a little more modern. They look like strange, deadly alien viruses.
This sounds really interesting. It seems to me that you are very conscious that you don't want the work of Tim Rollins and KOS to be seen as an extension of graffiti or hip-hop culture.
No, because it definitely comes from that. We all come from that. The kids, that's their, in a way, their artistic tradition was based in graffiti and comic books. That's the same, you know, before I knew anything about Western art history, I was into the X-Men as a working class kid growing up in rural Maine. That's how I learned to read.
Those were comics. Right?
Yeah, comics, Marvel Comics, X-Men, yeah. Teenage Mutants.
Right.
And so popular culture is really where our hearts lie. But we also didn't want to be trapped in that very narrow category of graffiti or hip hop. It was very narrow, and it's something, how do I put it? That was the work that everyone expected us to do.
Carlos, yeah. I was wondering if you feel that way about it too. I'm sure you have had friends who were graffiti artists, or you know, older brothers of friends.
Yeah. I love like drawing my name and making it to graffiti and stuff like that. And I was one time in Spain, and I was in a show of ours that we had in La Máscara Española, and this man comes up to me. He goes, "Excuse me, but where is your graffiti art? I don't see any art graffiti here." And I say, I told him, "Well, we're not drawing graffiti. This is the art that we make." And then he said, "Yeah, but I expected some kind of names and b-boy and guns and stuff like that." And he was like surprised that us South Bronx kids and Tim Rollins made collaborate into one and make these incredible pieces and beautiful at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Are there rules that students have to follow in order to stay with KOS?
Yes.
What are they?
Very strict rules. Well, first of all, you must be in school, or you must be in a GED program if you can't handle school. You cannot be a dropout and be part of KOS. I don't go for that. Another thing is that I'm not at all interested in the kids being involved in drugs, so that's out. And I'm not interested in them being teenage mothers or fathers. That's out. And so, because I'm not into supporting that sort of self-destructive behavior, that's all there is to it. So those are the basic outlines. And also, everyone has to have a modicum of respect for each other and not steal from the workshop. I mean, just basic, you know, ground rules of behavior that help us do the work that we do.
Mm-hmm. Carlos, you are now going to the High School of Art and Design in New York, right?
No.
Okay.
Well, I used to go there, but I was there for 3 years, and my teacher told Tim on the phone that there's no way I could get my diploma because of my reading level. And my teacher decided something with him and decided that if I'm going to be going to school and I don't even get to pass ninth grade, that the best thing for me to do is to be more involved in KOS and work there full-time and stuff like that while I work with my GD or something.
Right. So what we're doing is it's a situation in which Carlos and the school just didn't mix. And he was suffering the same things that he had suffered when I first met him in junior high school, avoiding school to avoid the pain of, you know, going through this. Art and Design is a wonderful school, but as we all know, the public school's resources are severely, severely limited. So if a kid has a very severe learning problem, it's almost impossible to really get that kind of care and attention that is necessary. So his counselor said, well, you know, the best thing you could do is to work with you for full time and get him a private tutor for the reading and stuff. So that's our approach, and that's what we're doing. So mm-hmm. it isn't like he's a high school dropout. It's that he had to exchange that learning situation for an alternative one, and it's been working really well, mm-hmm. really well.
Tim, what's the highest you've gotten for a painting?
The highest that we've gotten uh-huh. directly from the studio through our dealer, it's $100,000.
How's the money divided? Can I ask that?
Oh, sure. Well, you know, with the commercial gallery, they get 50%. That's the standard thing. And so the other money goes straight into the Art and Knowledge Workshop account, and from that, the kids all get paid salaries. I get paid a salary, pays for the trips that we take, all the expenses of the workshop, and also goes into acquiring works of art. We're starting a nice little collection of kind of artists from history that the kids like James Enzor prints and a Goya print we have, and Philip Guston. And then we also have money to support young artists that really need support at that point. And so we acquire work by younger artists like Felix Gonzalez-Torres and Daryl Ellis and Lorna Simpson. And so in that way, the wealth is spread as good as possible. But we're a nonprofit corporation.
Mm-hmm. What happens when someone's all grown up? I don't know if you've encountered this yet, but is there an age when you think someone ought to leave?
Oh, well, that's the point. It's not like Menudo, you know, where you get kicked out at puberty. But it's not like that. What I've always said, and in the case of all the kids, our oldest now is Jose Parisi. And he's 21. In some cases, too, Jose Parisi, I kicked him out for a year because it seemed like he was taking advantage of the workshop and using it as a crutch, using it as a nest, and not really using the opportunities that had been presented to him in a productive way. And I said, if you get it together and go to college and let me see what you do on your own and really grow up in a year, I'll give you 1 year, come back and we'll see how it works. And that's exactly what he did, and that worked very successfully. It was very painful for me, but it was really the right thing to do, and for the workshop, for myself, and I think especially for Jose.
Listen, I thank you both for talking with us.
Great.
Thanks.
Tim Rollins and Carlos Rivera. The America series of paintings by Tim Rollins and KOS is on view at the Dia Art Foundation in New York until June 17th. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. What story are you following, Robert?
Well, we'll be following Mikhail Gorbachev's meeting with Pope John Paul II in Rome, a report from Silvia Pacioli, and also a talk with an expert on religion in communist countries about very, very dramatic changes that are taking place now in the Soviet Union with respect to believers. Also, we'll be visiting with the Soviet family. Anne Garrels reports on how life under perestroika has been for them, and a story on where the sandhill cranes spend the winter.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Television critic David Bianculli says he thinks some people don't like watching TV news because it's too grim. But David says what gets him down is every time he sees a big news story about a murder or accident, he knows that he'll be watching it all over again in a year or two as a made-for-TV docudrama.
Some docudramas are good, like the one about the rescue of Jessica McClure. Some are awful, like the one about the murder trial of Robert Chambers. Either way, the idea that today's news is tomorrow's entertainment is now an accepted and annoying part of the TV landscape. Even the explosion of The Challenger is being made into a telemovie, and you can bet that in Hollywood right now, dramas about the California earthquake and the Berlin Wall are being pitched with more speed and spin than a Nolan Ryan fastball. Monday, NBC presents a docudrama called Howard Beach, Making the Case for Murder. It's about the 1986 incident in which a group of white youngsters in Queens, New York, chased and attacked three black men. Parts of that attack are dramatized as the movie opens, and it's pretty gruesome stuff. From then on, though, the movie sticks close to Special Prosecutor Joe Hines, who's assigned to investigate the case. and who's played by Daniel J. Travanti with all the emotion and conviction anyone could ask.
They chase a human being onto a busy highway. They see him crushed by a car at 55 miles an hour. They watch his body flying through the air almost half the length of a football field. Then they turn and chase another man four blocks and beat him to a bloody pulp with a metal bat. What kind of world is this?
Director Dick Lowry and writer Steve Bellow really stack the deck with the way the roles are cast. Travanti carries the fond associations from his years as Frank Farrillo on Hill Street Blues, while his assistant, Dan Loria, plays the likable dad on The Wonder Years. And when the Howard Beach case goes to trial, the defense attorney on the other side of the aisle is played by William Daniels, the abrasive Dr. Craig on St. Elsewhere.
The truth is, somebody died here by accident. An accident brought on by stupidity. Racism had nothing to do with it. I mean, these kids didn't have knives on them. And they didn't lie to you either.
So the casting isn't fair, but it sure is effective. So is the decision to refrain from presenting the suspects or victims in any so-called private moments. After the attack prologue, we never see or hear them unless they're being questioned by one of the attorneys or speaking in court. This doesn't make for very complete character portraits, but it does make Howard Beach making the case for murder a relatively responsible docudrama. And Joe Morton, as the eldest of the three black victims, makes quite an impact despite those restrictions.
Man, don't kill me. I got a son old as you.
There is one small bit of dramatic license in Howard Beach when a composite character is used in place of the Reverend Al Sharpton and his inflammatory team of advisors. But that's a minor complaint. This drama works because of its restraint, its fine acting, and, despite its depressing subject, a positive message.
I read somewhere that racism is a lot like child abuse. The victims in one generation become the perpetrators in the next. Well, now's our chance to do our bit to break that cycle.
If all docudramas were this good, they wouldn't make me so depressed.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Howard Beach, Making the Case for Murder, airs on NBC December 4th. Our interviews are produced by Phyllis Myers and Amy Sallet. Naomi Person produces the music reviews and commentaries. It's all edited and mixed by Roberta Sharrock and Joan Tuohy. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we speak with Nadine Gordimer about her life as a white South African novelist opposed to apartheid. Also, we meet the screenwriter of Shampoo in Chinatown and the director of Tequila Sunrise, Robert Towne. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.